Okay, everybody, we're going to get started. Thank you all for coming today. It's a real pleasure to have Eric Solheim here, who is the head of the DAC, which, as I've described to many people in the United States, I describe it as sort of the head of the Major League Baseball Commission on Development. And when I'm in Europe, I describe it as the FIFA of development, depending on the cultural context. And so I think we have a multicultural audience, so it's either the head of the Major League Baseball Commission, you can pick, but I think you get the general idea. It's housed within the OECD. It's the club of donors, the club slash think tank slash official convening body of the official donors of the world, including the United States, the UK, Norway, and others. Eric Solheim was Minister for Development Cooperation as well as for the Environment in Norway before taking this job. Has many friends in the United States. My friend and mentor, Andrew Natsios, speaks very highly of Mr. Solheim, and because many of you in the room know the big role that Norway has played in the issues around Sudan and helping bring peace to Sudan or to help stabilize Sudan. So, what I think is very timely, I mean, Mr. Solheim is here for the spring meetings of the World Bank and the IMF. I think that we have a chance to hear an update on the post-Busan goings-on in the donor world as in what's being called the Global Partnership for Development. So I think it's a timely moment to hear from Eric Solheim, who, I guess, you took the role in the last 6 months?
From 1st of January.
1st of January. So this is his first official visit to D.C., and so I think it's a nice opportunity for all of us to hear how he's seeing the world and what the future holds for official development assistance and beyond official development assistance. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the floor over to Eric Solheim. Thank you for coming to CSIS.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and I'm very much looking forward to the conversation. Let me start by bringing you into my thinking on development and some what I consider main trends in the development debate of today, and then we have a conversation on that basis. Quite often people ask, what is really development? And I think we should leave aside some of the intellectual debates and go right into the matter. And if you want to look to what is development in the world, I will propose the one place to go. The one place to go, if you really want to consider what development is all about, is to Panmunjom. That's the border crossing between South and North Korea. On one side of the border, abrupt poverty, stunted children, I mean, that's still children who have not reached their capacity of growth, hunger until very recently, simply one of the poorest places on Earth. The other side of the border, one of the most prosperous nations on the globe, far above the average of European nation, a democracy, very beautiful environmental policies, simply one of the most successful nations on the entire globe. Samsung is now selling more Galaxies than the Americans or Apple are selling iPhones, and even they capture the world with this Gangnam Style video, which is the most seen on the internet. And what all this is about, because that's the lesson learned, it's not about religion, because it's the same on both sides of the border. Well, there are a few more Christians in the south recently, but historically there is no difference. Not about language, not about culture, not about really about the difference between democracy and dictatorship, because most of the development in the south also happened at a time of at least authoritarian-style government. It's all about the difference between right and wrong political decisions. That's the core. So that's, of course, the core of development, to get the political decisions right. South Korea made all the right, while North Korea basically made all the wrong political decisions. So development is about getting the politics right. It's also about foreign investment. It's also about development assistance. For sure, South Korea has been one of the main recipients of development assistance in the world. It's part of the Cold War. The intentions may not have been just the intentions of Jesus Christ. It was part of the American fighting the Americans fighting the Cold War. But for sure, that development assistance helped. It was about integrating into the global market. It was so many different forces, but they all came together in good political decisions. And South Korea now, in realization of the fact that they were broadly helped by development assistance from the United States and other places, is now becoming a new donor. And that's, I think that's the best attest development assistance can ever get, that those who have benefited from it in the past are now embarking upon becoming donors. Why would they do that if they didn't find it useful? So this is the broad landscape, getting the political decisions right, integrating in the world market, not trying to stay outside that, getting assistance but having a good country system so that you can utilize the assistance. That's what gets good development also in other parts of the world. So what's new in the world of development? Obviously, the UNDOC, which I represent, is coming out of the aid community, the assistance community. That was, I think, based on two different political strains. One was the religious or political ambition to help other people. And we should not be ashamed of that. Jesus Christ says, whatever you want others to do to you, you should do to them. And no American would think that at a time of need, Americans should not get assistance from others. Why should America not help others in their time of need? So that's one underpinning ideological movement behind the aid, Christian, but in all other religions. And the other is, this is part of foreign policy. It's part of the hardcore foreign policy. If you want a world with less terrorism, less drug trafficking, less crimes, less chance of unstable government, you need to get a broad global development, because most cases of uncertainty in the world affecting my country, Norway, or the United States of America, is very poor places. I mean, if I look into the future of my daughter, she will live a life in Norway until, say, if she lives a normal life, she will die around 2090. And in that time horizon, nearly, I mean, there is absolutely no problem coming from our neighborhood. We are not afraid of the Swedes or the Danes, not even the Russians anymore. So, every real threat to her life is coming from some other place. From drugs in Afghanistan, from nuclear wars coming from North Korea, or from state collapse in Somalia, whatever it may be. So we want to integrate that into our development thinking. And as a minister in Norway, we fully integrated our foreign policy and our development policy, seeing it as one, seeing it also part of our broader Norwegian interests. I think that's absolutely legitimate. Some people may see it as an Americanization of our foreign policy, in the sense that this is what the United States have done all through, but I think it's the right thing to do. Well, then what are the main trends in development policies today? I will give you four. First big trend is obvious to everyone. We are moving towards a multipolar world, and it's affecting aid. The time when North America and Europe could dominate the world is for the young generation today as far as the Second World War was for my generation when I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s. It was something we spoke about. I was very happy to listen to my father telling about his experience during the Second World War, that we knew it will never come back in that form. And for the generation who is growing up today, the time where we, the white people of Europe and America, could dominate the world is far past. We are living in a multipolar world. For sure, the United States is still the most important power. China is for sure the second most important power in the world. But whatever real decision we want to make on world trade, on climate change, on regional conflict in Syria or Sudan, whatever it may be, we need to include America, Europe, India, China, Brazil, and a huge number of stakeholders. Also new nations coming up, Indonesia, Turkey, whoever they may be. This also affects aid, because aid is now not a one-way street anymore. A huge number of nations are both recipients of aid at the same time they're providers of aid. China is still a recipient of aid, even though it's a main provider of aid. Aid in the world is not going down, as some people think. It's for sure going up. it may have
plateaued
for the OECD for a period of time. But if you add up all the other providers of it, for sure it's clearly increasing. But a huge number of nations are both. Mexico, Chile, I'm going to Colombia next week. They intend to be both. We were visiting Indonesia 2 weeks back. Indonesia for sure has still had tens of millions of very poor people. But they also is in the process of establishing a USAID institution in Jakarta because they want also to provide to the world. And I think this is completely normal because development aid has never, ever just been about money. It's always been also about technology, ideas, intellectual exchange, providing examples and inspiration. I mean, what overwhelming inspiration can you, not get from the Korean fantastic development? But every nation is coming with their specific ideas and technologies, and in this learning process, there will be a two-way street, and that's also what the so-called Global Partnership for Efficient Development Cooperation is all about, to set up this exchange. Iceland, our latest new members of the DAC, they, for instance, will come with a first-class experience of geothermal power. No other nation I know of have the same knowledge of geothermal. So why shouldn't they specialize in that and use their aid efforts to make that exchange of technology easier? I was visiting Ireland last week. Ireland is, we all know, the one nation in the entire world which has a lower population today than it had in the 1850s. Nearly everywhere else, the population is tripled or even 10 times bigger than they were in the 1850s in Ireland. It's lower because of their enormous immigration to the US and other places, but also, of course, because of the hunger, which is the overwhelming starting point for modern Irish history. And they know it. And they know that the enormous success they've done in agriculture, now they're feeding 10 times the Irish population from their agriculture, while at 100 years back they couldn't even feed their own poor. They come to the world with enormous enthusiasm and engagement, but also technologies in agriculture, which they should provide. And I could go on, but let me just focus in on one of the new donors. I wanted to go to Mogadishu, Somalia, as a Norwegian minister. And then the security people come and say, no, you cannot go to Mogadishu. It's far too dangerous for a Norwegian minister to go there. But I said, I will go. And, well, you may have strong opinions, but at the end of the day, I decide. Well, we had to make a compromise, and I was allowed to go to Mogadishu airport and the full UN protection. Second time, we had the same conversation. Then I was allowed to go into town with helmet, bulletproof jackets, and everything which made the conversation with the Somali children very, very easy and very, very, very normal when you approach them. Then realizing in Mogadishu that Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey had not gone there in that way. He had gone there with his wife, with half his cabinet. There are hundreds of Turks all over Mogadishu. And the Turks have even provided the commercial lifeline now to Mogadishu, which is a normal Turkish airlines air route from Istanbul to Mogadishu. In the past, everyone had to go on a separate jet with full military protection from maybe in from Nairobi. Now, as a businessman or if you are a Somali living in the United States or Europe, you can go in normal commercial aircraft. And this enormous difference between our way of approaching Somalia and the Turkish way of approaching Somalia goes to the credit of the Turks, but it also shows the importance of all the new donors. And the global partnership which we want to establish is to have this conversation between the new kids on the block, to put it that way, the Chinese, the Indians, the Brazilians, but also the Mexicans, the Turks, and all the new providers of assistance with the traditional donors and with those relatively few nations who are still only recipients of aid. So that's number one. Second new thinking, or not new, but still trend, is that we must think of aid as the catalyst of all the other financial flows. Everyone knows that aid in the world is important and it's a big flow of capital, but private direct investment is much bigger. Trade is bigger. Illicit capital flows out of developed nations may be even much bigger. Remittances is three times bigger than aid. So there are so many different flows here, but we can use the aid catalytically to make maybe more and better private investment to assist developing nations and get everything out of the private investment. One example, again, a Norwegian example, maybe you are tired of those, but Norwegian oil company Statoil is paying more taxes per year to the state of Angola alone than Norway has provided for 50 years of development assistance, not to Angola, because that's not been a big recipient, but to Tanzania, which is the biggest recipient of Norwegian foreign aid. So it shows where the big money is. And so many African nations these days have an enormous opportunity if they can get their resource taxation right and their domestic resource mobilization. So the new global partnership we want to establish based on Busan with a ministerial meeting at the end of this year, the Nigerians have said at the top of the agenda should be domestic resource mobilization in developing nations. At the end of the day, that's about tax. I know that word is not very popular in the United States, but it's a necessary word. And I went to India. Sonia Gandhi had called a conference of the top leadership of the Congress Party, all the top leaders of India, about how India could make inclusive growth. It took 5 minutes, and it was a debate about taxation. How can India get a system where you get some taxes from the ultra-rich and from the emerging middle class to provide money for education and health? In the long run, for sure, you cannot get any real money for education and health in such a huge place as India from development assistance. That is to only be catalytic, but you can get a lot if you can do the domestic resource mobilization. So we want to use this global partnership as a vehicle for domestic resource mobilization, and that's taxation. The OECD has established a tax for development program. The French has established a tax inspectors without borders program, but it's about getting the taxation right. You need, if you are a developing nation, for sure international investment. Otherwise, you cannot develop. But there should not be super profit. There should be realistic, normal profits, and should get the taxation right. The third global trend on development is the absolute necessity to integrate development with environment. There are still separate strains, separate civil society organizations, separate ministries in all nations, separate UN organizations, separate global conferences. We must bring them together. Everyone understands that intellectually, but it's much, much more difficult to do than up to now thought of. For instance, there is absolute, as far as I have never heard of anything you can do for climate adaptation in a developing nation, which is not at the same time development. What would that be? I mean, if you're introducing a new seed to help the farmers of Burkina Faso, is it development or is it climate adaptation? If you assist the Ethiopians in constructing some dams to control the water of the Blue Nile, is it development or is it environment? If you assist in a solar panel program in the Sahel, is it development or is it environment? You can continue. There is absolutely no way of really separating the two, but they are separated in the global conversation and they must be brought together. I was in the Busan conference in 2011. The week after, there was the Durban conference on climate change. And frankly, except for a few UN officials, I think I was more or less the only person attending both conferences. And that's not to say that, there were good people in both conferences, but they were not speaking sufficiently together. And that's main ambition to assist in that. Fourth global trend is a shift in focus. The historical focus of OECD and DAC and on the donors was the focus on the donor effort. What did we do? The focus should, of course, be how relevant is this for the developing nations and for the world poor. We must shift in all our measurements of development from a focus on donor effort into a focus on recipient benefit. Again, I think most people would agree to this, but it's to get it done, to find the realistic ways of measuring, which is the trick, and we must do that. I can see that you want to go to the conversation, so let me then finalize with one last thought. There seems to be an emerging consensus that in the so-called post-2015 framework, which is the what will be the global aims of the world after 2015, there should be a focus on eradicating the absolute poverty. Absolute poverty is that you do not know what to eat tomorrow, that you die at young age from diseases which are completely curable, that you have no education, simply that you're trapped into a system which is nearly impossible for individuals to really get out of. We should focus in on that. But that is much more difficult to do than most people think. We should set that aim for sure, but we must develop the policies to do it. No nation up to this point developed with a focus on the absolute poor. But the States did not. In China, Deng Xiaoping said that someone has to be reached first. It's not a focus on the very poor. In my nation, some entrepreneurs, they went to the UK or to Germany and saw what happened there, and they came back to Norway copying that. It was not a focus on the very poor. Not even the labor movement was focused on the very poor. That came later. They focused on the most easily organizable part of the labor movement, which was the basically people in the printing houses, not the landlords out in the countryside. So how can we really make an effort for the extreme poor of the world? That conversation, I finalize with that. We need to look into all the cash-based schemes, which particularly Latin American nations have done for the very poor. Professor Yunus came here yesterday and got the Congressional Gold Medal for microcredit. That's not the one salvation for everything, but it's a very important tool to reach out to the very poor. Many of the extreme poor are in minority groups or indigenous groups or people who are very much discriminated in their own societies. How can we lift them out of that so they can realistically really fight for their own efforts? And finally, how can we uplift the small farmer? Because most of the very poor in the world are not in the cities, they are in the countryside. They're either landless or have a tiny farm. But how can we make that farm more productive, more efficient, so that it produces more and you lift them out of poverty with that aim? Conclusion. Development aid is a very, very important tool still for development, but it cannot be seen in isolation from any of the global trends. But if we can use it strategically to provide more private investment and strategically to have this conversation and this exchange of views across continents and between new and old donors and between nations who are donors, nations who are both donors and recipients, and nations who are recipients, we will have, I think, a bright future.
Eric, let me make a couple comments and ask you a couple questions. But I think about, I guess heaven is supposed to be the French are the cooks and the Italians are the lovers. And I'm thinking about, okay, the French are the tax collectors and the Norwegians are the cooks and I'm not sure. So I think it's very interesting, this issue of this domestic resource mobilization. I think the UNDP had a very interesting study that looked at the amount of domestic resource mobilization in Africa from 2000 to 2010. It, in essence, quadrupled from something like $100 billion to $400 billion. So absolutely, and if you compare it to, say, all the DAC ODA money, which I guess is about $120 billion, and it's not all in Africa, it's sure as heck, like you said, it's a lot bigger piece of the pie. Tax policy is an important conversation. I know France actually does have a comparative advantage on this. I'm looking at my friend from AFD who's here. Could you talk a little bit more about how other donors are thinking about tax policy? Because I do think this is something that I actually think there's lots of people have opinions in the United States about taxes, but nobody says we shouldn't collect any taxes. There are arguments about how simple it should be, what loopholes it should be, what the rates are. How do you do it? But I think those are interesting conversations. You know, you said earlier it's about politics. Development is about politics. And I think sometimes in the development community here in the United States, we shy away from that. That's the first thing, is if you could talk a little bit about that. And then could you talk about this issue of I hear you about development and the environment. I actually get the sense from much of the conversations, at least in Washington, it's not so much development and the environment that need to come together, it's so much development and trade need to come together. Could you talk about those two issues? So taxes and trade. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, on the first, on taxes, I mean, I think everyone agreed that you need a tax system, so that's not a conversation. And I think also basically everyone agreed that you need, I mean, the time where people saw foreign companies as a kind of plundering of developing nations is gone. Every nation in the world, maybe with the exception of North Korea, but I don't know, even in that case, every nation in the world wants more and better private investment. They want American, European, Japanese, Korean, the neighbors' companies to come and invest, but they want to do it with a realistic profit and in a responsible manner. What can we do? We can assist developing nations in setting the tax systems right so that they get the foreign investment, but that there are no super profits. One way of doing that is to provide tax inspectors or tax people with detailed tax knowledge, and they will normally not be within that aid community. They were coming from ministers of finance and other places.
And it really gets the heart pounding. It's so emotionally compelling to talk about taxes, right? I'm kidding, right? But
and they can, for instance, assist a nation in looking into the broader tax system, but they can also be very specific, looking into our copper industry in Zambia, our oil industry, emerging oil industry in Tanzania. Do we have the right systems? Do these contracts, which are offered by Statoil or Exxon, are they at the same global standard as the contracts offered by Statoil or Exxon in China, or a nation where everyone knows that it could take care of its own interest in their own manner? And we need also to look into the global systems. Do international companies have a policy of transferring the profit to some place where it's not really taxed? The British Minister of Finance made a maybe PR stunt, but it was quite effective, saying that some American companies like Starbucks and Google were not paying taxes in the UK. For sure, I mean, everyone would expect that if they're not paying taxes in the UK, they will not be paying taxes in Burkina Faso or Nepal. I have no proof of that, but I think we will all agree that's likely. So to have people looking into the internal pricing in global companies to see if that is fair, that's another vehicle. And OECD is providing both direct assistance to nations in setting their tax systems right and the ability to look into to this pricing. On trade, for sure, the difficulty here is, of course, that the very poor nations have very little ability also to trade. It's more difficult today to do what the Koreans did, because the Koreans in the 60s and 70s had absolute access to a protected market in the US. That time there was no real competition from China or anyone else. So if you want to start up something in many African nations today, for sure the world market is different, and it's not easy. At least in the case of Norway, we have absolutely no formal trade restrictions towards the least developed nations in the world. Still, as a guess, I would think there is less than 0.2% goods from Africa in a Norwegian supermarket. It's as close to zero as it can ever be. So looking into what are the realistic ways African nations can trade with their neighbors and approaching, integrating in the world market, how they can build the institutions, the systems, and also looking into all the informal trade restrictions which may be there. For instance, we have extremely high standards for a reason. I'm an environmentalist, so I fought all these struggles in our parliament for high environmental standards. But of course, some of these high standards may be seen as hidden protection from a point of view of developing African nations. I mean, I looked into, for instance, if, say, Uganda wanted to sell meat on the Norwegian market, in according to the rules, they would have to inject 2 million cattle in the surrounding area, and they have to fence it off. And there was enormous infrastructure investments which would be needed to fit with the sanitary and environment regulation of our markets. This may be fair, but it's not easy to penetrate such a market based on the present system.
Let me just ask one more question. could you talk a little bit about how, as you're talking to your donor stakeholders, how they're interpreting the issue of what does local ownership mean? This is a big part of the conversation. Here in Washington, there's, a lot of energy around the discussion at USAID, and I'm not asking you to comment specifically on that, but if you could just speak more broadly to how are donors interpreting the concept of what local ownership means for them?
I think the new catchphrase is country systems, that we should assist developing nations in building country systems, and even much more so, many, many developing nations today have country systems. We should feed into those and not create any kind of parallel structures or anything which is undermining those structures. I mean, in the neighboring room here, we have the Prime Minister of Haiti, as far as I understand.
Yes.
Haiti has long been called in the development world the Republic of the NGOs. That's not to denigrate what many NGOs did in Haiti. For sure, they had the best intentions and did a lot of good stuff. But it did not construct a functioning Haitian state. And in the long run, unless the Haitian can do that, I think our efforts will be limited efficiency in Haiti. I mean, look to this island of Hispaniola. There are two states at the same island. The Dominican Republic is six times richer per capita than the Haiti. If you fly over it, you see the border, because on the Dominican side is 40% tree cover. On the Haitian side, it's 0.7% tree cover. So you see it, see the border from there, as no other place in the world. I mean, the only place where it's a bigger difference is between North and South Korea. And this is due to political decisions, but also due to the fact that a really working Haitian state providing political decisions and services to the people have not been established. And we are also to be blamed for that because we did not feed into the country systems.
Eric, I will just gently disagree and just suggest that I'm not sure that we would have – that I'm not sure that the differences between the Dominican Republic and Haiti are a result of running monies through – the DR systems or the Haitian systems,
sure,
of course.
Not,
but I think, but and I know you're not necessarily saying that, but I do also want to say, I mean, you talked earlier about politics, and I think that you talked about the strains that support foreign assistance, and I just want to raise something. I think oftentimes the development community forgets that there is a political accountability to the American taxpayer or the developed country taxpayer, certainly in the U.S., which has always had a fragile support in the United States for foreign assistance. Doesn't mean there isn't support. There is. But every time that money is absconded from governments, so if you run money, I think we've written a report here at CSIS that says we should not conflate running money through the pipes of governments with capacity building. And so my concern about that interpretation of local ownership is that it's too simplistic to say that if we run money through the pipes of governments, that that's the same as capacity building. I know you're not necessarily saying that, but I oftentimes hear people in the development advocacy community say things that sound like that. And then separately, I think the first time that there is a scandal, I think people have to remember that. I think in the United States, the argument I've made is that if money's absconded from, and I'm going to ask my friends who are associated with Malawi to forgive me, but if the health minister of Malawi absconds with the money, or somehow the money disappears, other than us putting an Interpol watch out for the health minister of Malawi and saying, can I have my money back, that's not a satisfactory set of accountabilities. And I don't think it's acceptable for the development community to tell the taxpayers, well, there's some shrinkage and slippage in the system, and what are you going to do? There's corruption, and hey, and shrug our shoulders and say, look, you know, there's this corruption stuff, and I'm really sorry about it, but you just keep sending me ODA. I don't think that's an acceptable case in this environment of fiscal austerity, certainly in the United States. I don't know about in Europe, but I don't think that's a sellable argument. And so I think what's happened here in the U.S., and I know I'm not asking you to comment on it, and is that I think this is going to be the big risk, and it's been hard to have a debate about it because many of the folks who are in the implementer community who are NGOs or consulting firms are perceived as if they make the argument that it's done out of self-interest, and maybe there's some truth to that, but I also think I think my friends in the implementer community have a point, and that's why we came out with the report saying let's not conflate money running through pipes as capacity building, and let's not forget that there is political accountability challenges here in the U.S. because I think you rightly pointed out at the beginning. So if you could just again, if you would just comment on that, and then I'll stop. But I think you've raised an interesting point, and you were just answering my question, which was to say, how are donors thinking about this issue? Saved by the phone. Is that a Samsung? Exactly. Is that a Samsung?
It's not because I was not allowed to buy that. But I have to admit that from kind of ideological reasons, or also my fascination with the Korean example, I wanted to buy a Samsung. Yeah, but that was not on the OECD scheme. Nor I mean, I have one from the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs. One from OECD, both are Apple. So
Eric, without putting on this, but maybe you could just talk about this political accountability to taxpayers. Yeah. Maybe that's a way to.
We are in absolute agreement, because that is the number one killer of the support for development assistance in Europe and the United States and every other provider. I mean, when I met people in the streets of Norway, there are some NGO people from Norway here, the message will be very, very simple. Very fine, Eric. I see you on TV going down to Africa helping people there. Very fine. But how do I know that my money is not ending up in the pockets of a corrupt dictator? That's the number one, two, and three issue. And if we cannot reply satisfactorily to that, we will have no support for development assistance, as I see it. What's the answer? The answer is to be absolute on. I mean, we should assist and use the country systems. We have to be absolute on that matter. But we should not be absolute on every other matter in addition, because we tend to be that. I give you one example. We from Norwegian side, we were embarking upon a very far-reaching support for the government of Guyana on rainforest. Guyana has the lowest rate of deforestation anywhere in the world, Guyana at the northeastern tip of Latin America. We said there is just two conditions here. Our systems must be corruption-proof to the extent that is feasible, but we will put every effort into that. And they should be based on a mutual agreement on the level of that you reduce or keep low the level of deforestation. Except that we will not make the decision. You will decide how it's done. But for sure, the huge number of people in our parliament, in our civil service, among our civil society organizations, who thought they know much better how to protect the rainforest of Guyana than the government of Guyana. And that I reject.
Fair enough. Let's open it up to questions. I'm going to do this World Bank style, since it's around the World Bank spring meeting. So we're going to collect several questions, so I'll give a chance also for Eric to think about how he wants to answer. My friend Jerry Hyman, I want to call on Jerry, I want to call on Kurt Reinsma, and I want to call nobody from overseas, my friend from France. You don't want to make a comment? But, okay, but so I'm going to ask Jerry first, then Kurt Reinsma, then I want to have my friend from France make a comment. Then I'm also going to see the gentleman here. So those four, and we can do them quickly. We'll do a second round. So,
yes.
And just
Thanks.
Quickly identify yourself, by name, and keep the question brief so everyone has an agreement. Okay.
Thanks. I'm Jerry Hyman at CSIS, but I was at AID for a few years. And my question follows Dan, really, and about the Paris Declaration in Busan. You started by saying that the difference between North and South Korea were policy and political decisions. And it seems to me that's exactly right. The Paris Declaration takes country ownership, to follow Dan's point, and conflates it with the government. Yet, it seems to me that, my question is, what is the DAC position, or what are the donor positions on the internal political economies of these recipient countries? You talked about domestic resources. The amount of domestic resources in illicit flows, in corruption, in narcotics flows, and so on and so forth, far, far outweigh the amount of money going to these countries in ODA. So if we don't tackle, or if someone isn't prepared to tackle the political economy of these countries, how do you get these right policies between Haiti and Dominican Republic, or between South Korea and North Korea? And are the donors, is the DAC, prepared to get into the internal political structures and internal political systems of the recipient countries to be sure that these funds, not just the donor funds, but the domestic funds, are going to the right places and not into the pockets of the government elites.
Thank you very much. A really great presentation. Any one of your major trends could be the topic of days of discussion. I wanted to just sort of try to connect two of the themes. One is the change in the sort of world structure, aid flows, and using aid as a catalyst as opposed to just the old kind of check-writing mode, and the environmental trend, the integration of development and environment. Some people would argue that the world, from an environmental, climate change, other points of view, cannot sort of afford 1.2 or 1.5 billion Chinese consuming at the same level that America and Western Europe have gotten used to consuming. And then if you sort of look at those investments from the South-South investments around the world, not that the West has always been environmentally responsible, but you get my drift here. How do you sort of connect, and I'm a big believer in private investment and our role as a catalyst in private investment, but how do you sort of connect the need for a green development approach going forward with large-scale investments by companies and state-owned enterprises that don't necessarily have that perspective? I had an interesting meeting a while back with a group of Chinese state-owned companies, and I was talking about doing well and doing good is the way we often phrase it in the U.S., and one of them interrupted me, and it was a very frank exchange, and he basically said, at the beginning, just doing well is okay. We'll worry about the doing good part later on. Could you just comment on that?
Thank you very much for a good statement and presentation. My name is Jackson Kinyanjui. I'm from Kenya. And I just wanted to agree with you that perhaps one of the spirits of the Paris and Busan Declaration is actually use of country systems. And we are also aware that where systems are not comfortable, donors have tended to use the CSOs. But one of the challenges that we've been facing is really ensuring that we still live to the spirit of Busan and Paris of reducing transaction costs, so that even if the funds go through the CSOs, there isn't a lot of transparency. And I don't know what you have to say about that, because sometimes it's difficult for one to see exactly what really goes through CSOs, and sometimes harmonizing that with what government is doing. And and then the other thing, I think one of my colleagues also spoke about it, is the use of private investment, the PPPs, the South-South cooperation as way of trying to finance funding in the developing countries. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, I'm from France, and I believe in the Inspector Without Frontier. I think domestic resource mobilization is really a key importance. Just a quick remark maybe on the South-South cooperation and new donors. I think in the post-2015 agenda, we have the chance of building on this idea of a global partnership, but also feeding, the substance of what was launched in Busan and finding this momentum. And I think we have, you were talking about the convergence of different processes too, and I think the post-Busan momentum has to be maybe fed into also this idea of a global partnership. And it would be too bad to have this global partnership emerging from post-2015 discussions and not linking it to the post-Busan process. So I don't know how you see this possibility of, presenting the global partnership agreed on, endorsed in Busan, as a way, being completely coherent with the global partnership that the post-2015 discussions are talking about and trying to elaborate on.
All very easy questions. Okay, let's take a couple more questions. My friend Bob Berg, my former colleague at AID, the woman up here, and then let's see, make sure this woman over here, and I see we've covered the geographic waterfront of the room. So Bob first, please.
Thank you. I was the founding chair of evaluation at the DEC, so long ties. When I look at some of the most difficult political issues in the world, the Middle East, the flashpoints in South Asia, I see two flaws. One is that we have a bilateral approach in our development. And secondly, we have a derivative approach. That is, we say, let's let the politics get to be really positive and all the agreements sealed, and then we can do something in development, as opposed to what is normal, which is to build confidence among the parties because of increased ties, and then maybe the agreements follow that. So I'm wondering, even though I know the DAC Secretariat's not under your direct, you know, control on this, whether maybe the development community could think of other models of solving these regional difficulties by putting forth leading proposals and breaking away from the bilateralism and the derivative nature of our thinking about development.
Thank you. Ann Phillips. I'm currently at USIP. Thank you for your presentation. A question, a very concrete question. The New Deal for Engagement in Fragile States is a part of the Busan Agreement, and there are several pilot cases. And I'm just wondering, I think 7 or 8, to what extent is the DAC monitoring how these cases are developing? It's all about using host country systems, host country leadership and assessment, host country priorities. And will reports, is the DAC monitoring how this is developing, and will those reports be available? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alexis Owa from the Center for Global Development. Thanks so much for your comments, and I agree with many of your observations. I was curious, kind of in light of that and the changing role and nature of aid that you discussed, and also your experience with RED and things like what we at CGD call cash on delivery aid. I was curious to think about, to hear about your current thinking on measuring aid effectiveness. I guess it's a similar question. How you think about measuring it and monitoring that?